All right, now I was told regarding this particular talk that it was to be a little more informal. I'd like to maybe set out some themes for you and then leave some room for questions or rebuttals or just conversation among us. We come to a very complex topic in that, or maybe, well, I'll just say complex, is fatherhood and mercy, or mercy and fatherhood. And it's not the first combination of things that we think about, but since the whole theme of the weekend is mercy, and how does that relate to being a father and fatherhood? And I would say it relates to mercy in sometimes paradoxical ways. Now, what is a paradox? Well, paradox comes from the Greek, meaning kind of alongside or a little bit off to the side of what we would normally think. Para, off to the side, and doxa, meaning teaching. So it's a kind of a teaching that is not what you initially or immediately think. And so there are certain paradoxes of mercy that come up with what I wanted to discuss with fatherhood. And then there's some other obvious things.
And father is in the confessional.
Good, okay. So let me read to you a quote, though. I think that I want to, first of all, as a kind of an introduction, my brothers and sisters who are here, beware of false mercy. There's a lot of false mercy around today. It's fake. It isn't the real thing. It's a mere kindness, which at times, kindness is really cruel. Kindness is not what is needed. Kindness can become a cruelty because it manifests a lack of conviction to the truth. It manifests a lack of, and it's really only the truth that can set us free. And so sometimes people, in order to speak of mercy, often want to soft pedal the truth. They want to soft pedal, but only the truth can set us free. So you do that, and it's a form of cruelty. Okay? So with that in mind, let me read to you something that Father Bishop Barron said in his book, Vibrant Paradoxes. He says this: many receive the message of divine mercy as tantamount to a denial of the reality of sin, as though sin no longer mattered. But that's just the contrary is the case. To speak of mercy is to be intensely aware of sin and its particular form of destructiveness. Sin and its particular form of destructiveness. Now, if you're a father, the first thing you want for your children is that they grow up, that they have integrity, that they come to wholeness, and that the cancer of sin is not rampaging through them. You want to give them a good start, and you want to keep the long term in mind. Just their immediate happiness. Daddy, give me the candy. I want the candy. There could be an immediate kind of kindness. But at the end of the day, you want to keep something more long-term in mind. Self-control and realizing you just can't have everything you want when you want it, when you want it. You want your children to have true happiness, not apparent happiness. See? And apparent happiness is always to be gratified in the moment. I want what I want when I want it. Give it to me now. But that's not always the best answer. And it's not mercy to just give kids what they want or to never to punish them or to just be nice and never raise difficult issues. That is a fake mercy. That is a false mercy. So, again, I'll just read the definition, all right? Many receive the message of divine mercy as tantamount to a denial of the reality of sin, as though sin no longer mattered. But just the contrary is the case. To speak of mercy is to be intensely aware of sin and its particular form of destructiveness. Destructiveness. So the first mercy that every father has for his children is that he wants for them what is truly best, not simply what is apparently best or what is best in the moment. He wants their overall, he wants their overall beatitude so that they can reach it to the goal, so that they can get to the finish line with Jesus. You see the idea? So the very first mercy that every father has is that he wants what is truly best for his children. He doesn't minimize sin. He's not obsessed with it, but he doesn't minimize it because he realizes that sin is a very pernicious cancer that will destroy and devour the lives of your children if it goes unchecked. Okay? It's a great mercy to teach them. It's a great mercy to insist on what is right. Now, with that in mind, I think a cultural background that we have today, and I'm not saying that's true of any father here, but I'm just going to say that generally speaking, when we look around the American scene, we see that too many fathers are passive fathers and passive husbands. Okay, I don't have time. Talk to your mother. Okay. And you're supposed to be the spiritual leaders of your household. First one up on Sunday morning. As for me and my household, we're going to serve the Lord. Time to get to Mass. Kids, get up. As it is, too many wives, if the husband goes at all, she has to drag him with the kids. Now, that is not right, my brothers. Right? You're to be the high priest of your household. You're to be the true spiritual leader. Now, I'm not saying your wife or the mother of the kids can't read them Bible stories, but you, by gosh, you ought to be reading them Bible stories. You ought to be insisting with them that we sit down and we pray together, teaching them to pray, reading them Bible stories, giving them instruction out of those Bible stories, right? And saying, now look, what is this Bible story teaching us? And you're teaching your kids, see? But again, this is often consigned to the mother. Oh, let the mother handle that. But if you look in Ephesians chapter 6, it says, fathers, teach your children in the ways of faith. It doesn't say mothers. It says fathers. Fathers do that. Now, that doesn't mean your wife can't or shouldn't. It just simply means that you are the first spiritual leader of that household. You should be the first one up on Sunday morning. You should be the first one saying, come on, kids, gather around. We're reading a Bible story, and we're going to talk about what it means. And you're the first one who's teaching them different prayers and showing them. And of course your wife is going to be part of that, of course. But the kids know that you're serious about it too. And you've heard a lot of these things. You don't need me to give you all the statistics, but you can always know that one of the chief indicators of whether your children will practice the faith going forward is whether you are in church, whether you practice the faith, whether you're serious about it. I know that's politically incorrect, but children will, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. Some of the studies show that if a father's not practicing the faith, the likelihood that the children will continue going to church after they reach emancipation is about 15%. Pretty low. But if the father is practicing the faith, and that's just in some perfunctory way, but he's practicing the faith, is almost 75% of kids will be practicing that faith when they're adults. It's a huge difference. It's not politically correct to talk like that, but it's just a fact. So your children's salvation is depending on whether you're serious about this. Now you're here. You probably don't need to hear this. You got some brothers, you got some friends. Tell them that kind of stuff, right? We got to get serious because a lot of our kids are going to get lost. Lost in the world and finally lost on their way to salvation. And God's not going to force them to keep the commandments any more than you can. But he's asking you as fathers to have this first mercy in mind, that the greatest mercy that you can give to your sons and daughters is to be serious about your own practice of the faith and to be serious about them practicing the faith and being raised up in it and being well schooled in it, okay? And don't just leave it to the catechist or their mother. Sit them down, read them Bible stories, or, you know, do some religious instruction with them, see? Or as they get older, when moral topics come up, by gosh, you're going to be talking to them about that stuff. Or when stuff's in the news, LGBTQI, LMNOJQ, whatever. As these things come up, you've got something to say to them, see? And maybe you need to first gather with other brothers or gather with the priest and say, what do I need to say? But say, learn it and say it, see? So let me go through some of these ways that we can show mercy, but don't forget that first mercy. Sin is like a cancer, and that's why we need mercy. But mercy isn't some abstract, you know, fairy dust. Mercy is an active work of God to stay with us in a conversation, to bring us to our senses, for heaven's sakes, and shake the sin out of us. I say, oh, well, no worries, sin's okay, don't worry, don't get all worked up. I don't really care if you go to church or if you're having sex with your boyfriend. God does care about that, and so should we. And so mercy is a vigorous virtue wherein God says, I will stay in this conversation with you until I shake you back to your senses. Or you finally walk away from me, but I'm not leaving. But I'm going to still speak the truth. And my brothers, that's the model we need to have, right? Okay. Let me back up a little bit and talk about some other types of mercy, though, that I think a father can have for his children. Now, this first one is probably a hard one at times. And that is the first mercy, one of the great mercies you can show your children is to love their mother. Hello? To love their mother.
Amen.
To respect their mother. To show tenderness. You know, your children love their mother. They have tensions with them, of course. I just remember growing up how important it was for me. Whenever I heard my parents argue, I would just go to a very dark place. It scared the heck out of me, frankly, to hear my parents argue. But to see them reconcile was a beautiful thing, too. And one of the first mercies that we already talked about, but again, among these first mercies, is just that beautiful gift that you give your children to say, you really love their mother. You care about her. The Bible says that the Lord confirms a mother's authority over her children. Well, so should you. Don't let your children divide you and your wife. And they're good at it. They don't mean to be, but they are. And so stand with your wife. Confirm her authority over the children. I remember my father was very firm on this. He always said, when we would talk back to my mother, he'd say, come here, sit down. Don't you ever talk to your mother again that way. First of all, she's my wife and I love her. Don't you talk to my wife that way. And she's your mother and you're a child and she's an adult. And look what she's done to you and look what she's given you. Now you go back and tell your mother you love her and you're sorry. My father was very firm. He would not tolerate us disrespecting my mother. He confirmed her authority over us, see? And he never corrected her in terms of any authority she took over us publicly. If they had private discussions, I don't know. But I do know this, that even though at times I might have had different philosophies about what should be done, my father always insisted that we love my mother and respect her. And so again, these are the first mercies you can show your kid, but also your wife, right? Support her, encourage her, love her. Now, I was not born yesterday. I'm not married in the way most of you are. I mean, you know, but I do have a spouse, the church. She's a gorgeous, drop dead gorgeous spouse. Very demanding, long honey-do list. But beautiful, but demanding. But you know, I know this. There's tension in marriage. I know that. There's a lot of tension. You know, you can have a bunch of beers with the guys and debate politics and joan on each other and have real serious differences and just order another round of beer. See? But that's because, but you go home and you don't have that option, right? Because marriage is about the things that matter. It's about land and property and all that, but it's about kids, it's about future, it's about the stuff that really matters. And there's a lot of tension in marriage. And you need to just be sober about that. The very best marriages have tension in them. See, I think that one of the problems we have with marriage today is that a lot of people expect marriage to be an ideal, and if there's any ordeal, they want to look for a new deal. And the problem is that we want marriage to be an ideal, and there is no such thing. There's no ideal marriage. I'll tell you why. The very first reason that your marriage is not ideal or perfect is because you are in it. The very first reason that the church is not a perfect church is because I am a priest in it, and I am a pastor. Own your own stuff first, right? And realize that your marriage isn't perfect because you're a sinner. And also, you happen to have married a sinner. Sorry to say so. That's what you did. Shouldn't have done that, should you? All right. Marriages are going to have tension. Learn to love your wife anyway. And don't think it's going to be automatic. Years ago, I was kind of upset and frustrated in a parish where I was assigned, and my spiritual director said, Charles, do you love those people? I said, oh, of course I love them. I said, you're giving me the stock answer. That's the required answer. Give me the real one. Because you don't really love them. You just tolerate them. And I got mad, which is a perfect sign he was right. I got news for you. He said, you go home, get on your knees, and beg God to help you to love those people, even with the scintilla of the amount of love he has for them. And I'm going to tell you right now, a lot's going to change. You still have to deal with some of these issues, but you're going to deal with them in a very different way because you love them. And they will know that you love them, and they will respond in a different way. Now, you say, well, it's just natural to love my wife. No, it is not. People do fall out of love. The I do becomes you'd better. And an awful lot of tensions and things. There can be great, great anger and frustration in marriages. You've got to beg God every day for the grace to really love your wife with a tender love and your children with a tender love. Because the mercy that you're going to show them has got to come from that love, even when there is tension, and there will be tension, because love is about things that matter. So expect it. Love your wife anyway. Love your children anyway. Okay? And this is an important mercy to show, but you got to ask for it. I'm not trying to give you a moralism and say, come on, out of your own flesh power, love your wife. Love your children's mother. That's how you show mercy to your children. You love their mother. Yes, that's all true. But it's got to be a gift from God if it's going to last. If you try to love, really love, with a tender love, out of your own flesh, it'll last about 10 minutes max and you're back in the soup, right? Now, again, I'm not saying every marriage is tortured and everyone's screaming and hollering, but I just know there's tension in marriage, even the best marriages, all right? So, one of the ways to show great mercy for your children is to love tenderly their mother, to love her, to support her. Another mercy is to get well yourself. Stay in your lane, work your own stuff. Y'all got issues. I got issues. All of us got issues. Sometimes it's with anger. Maybe it was with drinking too much. Maybe there's some pornography. Whatever you've got going on, you work that issue. That's a mercy that you show your kids. Do not inflict your issues on your kids. Get well. Get well. All right? You see the vision, right? Get well. The Lord wants to heal you so you can be an even better healer and lover of your children and your wife. See? And again, I'm not saying everyone here has all those issues. I'm saying whatever yours are, see? Whatever they are. Sometimes it's not having enough anger. You're too passive. You're just too, oh, whatever, you know, okay. Maybe you need to find a backbone. I was going to put another word, but the ladies are here. But, you know, find a backbone. You need to say, look, and you know, sometimes we lack courage. Not that we struggle with anger, but sometimes it's that we lack courage and we're not angry enough. The Greek, well, the word meek, which is kind of comes across weakly in English, but in Greek, it's a very vigorous thing. Meekness, parotes, is the Greek word. Meekness is the proper, as Aristotle defines it, and St. Thomas also takes it up, meekness is the proper middle ground between too much anger and not enough anger. There's a time to be angry. But that anger doesn't mean we throw the furniture and curse. It means that we say, this will end. And we're firm about it. And our anger is the energy for us to stay firm and committed to what needs to be done. See? So I don't know what your issues are. I'm just saying, if you got them, go to the Lord and say, I got him. Help me to be well. Because it's a great mercy. If you can show me mercy, Lord, this will be a great mercy for my children. I want to be a merciful father. And therefore, Lord, I need to make sure that I'm not bringing stuff to the table that's going to be hard for my kids. Help me to love their mother. Help me to get well myself if I've got some issues, and we all do. All right? Another mercy that you can show for your children, it's a hard one in our economy, but is to get right that your vocation is more important than your career. See, our careers are very ego, especially if you got a job where, you know, you've got a few people, you can, you know, you got some authority in the job, and at the job they might call you sir. And if you ask her, you said something's got to be done, it gets done. Or if there isn't, there's going to be consequences, whatever, you know. There can be a lot of ego satisfaction. You know, you get money, you know, you get paid, you've got some skills you're showing, maybe you've made your way up the ladder a little bit. So there can be a lot of ego stuff at work. And then you come home, oh, Dad. Or the honey-do list comes out and you're not Mr. Jones anymore, you're Joe or Dad. Now, you see what I'm saying? We can easily slip into allowing our career to eclipse our vocation. Your vocation is husband and father. Your career is whatever you do. And I'm not saying, I don't mean to brush it aside. It's probably one of the main ways you provide for your children. I'm not trying to completely separate them, but when it comes to the essential work. Your most essential work is to be a husband and father. That's your vocation. And of course, to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And if the career begins to significantly impede being a disciple of Jesus Christ, so that they're asking you to do immoral things at work or support immoral things, or if it starts to interfere with you spending any reasonable time with your children and your wife, then guess what's got to give? See? But now how will I pay the bills? I don't know, but I want you to trust God, and I want you to start getting, you know, your priorities, because that's a great mercy for your family. You know, the danger is that they barely know you. You're the grouchy guy that comes home tired, and they're kind of glad when you go back out the door. You know, don't allow that to happen. And I know we live in crazy times. I know it. There's 1,000 stories, you know. But somewhere, we have to keep saying, Lord, show me how to get my vocation to be more important to me, than my career. Wonderful though the career can be, see? And you may be doing a great work out there, but your first job is at home. And so that kind of leads me to a kind of another mercy that you can show your family as a father. And that is that, again, as I said to you, that the father is really to be the spiritual leader of his home, the kind of high priest of the household. And in the book of Ephesians, it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and handed himself over for her. And that handed over, paradidomi, always refers to the crucifix or the crucifixion. And then he says, he handed himself over for her, and he says, to cleanse her by the bath of water with the word, so that she, his bride, might be holy and spotless without any blemish. So also should husbands love their wives. Now, husbands, you can't purify your wife in the literal sense that Jesus does, right? Only God can do that, and likewise, by extension, your children. But what this text is getting at is that your wife has been cleansed and sanctified by the Lord, and your children too. And now your job is to, if you will, as the leader of that household, make sure that household has the structures of grace more than the structures of sin, where it's easier for them to live their Christian faith rather than more difficult. So let me give you a couple of scenarios just to show you the difference. Let's take a negative example first and then show a merciful example. The negative example is, take a man who does not really love his wife. And he really likes his career more than being a husband and a father. In fact, because, you know, as I said, at the job, they call him sir and they do what he says. And he's got a lot of power there and influence. And some of the ladies are coming on to him. In fact, he started having an affair with one of them. Now, back home, of course, the wife starts to pick up on this, and she's angry and bitter. She knows something's up. She barely sees him, and the kids, they hardly see him. He's always away. I got to work. Got to work overtime. Got to get this thing, you know. But don't worry. Bring it home, and got a salary increase coming. You're going to love all the new money you get. And they barely know the guy. And so let's just say there's two kids in the picture. You've got a husband and a wife now, where there's tension, and the kids pick right up on it. Say they're in early high school, all right? He's starting to run with the boys, smoking some weed, and starting to get into trouble. He's been arrested for shoplifting once already, and he's in trouble. He's in trouble. She's already tested positive for herpes, and she's on her way to getting pregnant, and she's got all kinds of stuff. She wants to go get a tattoo, and she's confused. All right. Now, just stop the tape. Pretty ugly scene, right? But it all starts with a man who doesn't really love his wife. And who's allowed his career to eclipse. Now, that's the structures of sin. They're all contributing to it. All the members of the family are contributing to it. But it's bigger than any one of them. That's the structures of sin. Now, let's look at a more merciful picture, the structures of grace. Take a man who really loves his wife, and he realizes that his first job for her is to help her to lay deeper hold of her love of God and her own salvation and her own relationship with Jesus Christ. And so he prays with her, and he encourages her, and they pray together. And he's a spiritual leader in his home, and he's saying to those kids, by gosh, kids, this is what God says. And he's reading them Bible stories and encouraging them and confirming the mother's authority over the children and supporting her. And yes, he's got a job, but he gets there and he gets home as quickly as he can. He's not obsessed with power and money. He wants to stay home and be with his kids because he loves his wife and he loves his kids. And now The kids are beginning to respond. They see two parents who love each other. They've learned to depend on them. And she's on the debate club, and she's going places in the National Honor Society. And by gosh, you know, he's playing sports, and he's coming into his own. He's in the physics club or whatever. You see the idea. Now, that's the structures of grace, and it's not sin-free, but it's a lot easier to live the Christian life. And that is a great mercy when a father, through leadership, can say, as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. I am under God's authority, and boy, do I know it. And I will answer to him. And because I will answer to him, I will act with you toward with justice, with mercy, with kindness and patience. I will correct when I need to, and I will support you, and I will praise you as well. But I am here for you, see. And that is a very great mercy when a man loves his wife and his kids that way. That's the structures of grace. And it's an intentional, not just an accidental result. He's made a decision, as for this household that I lead, we're going to serve the Lord. See? And that's a great, great mercy. Another great mercy that a father can give to his children is to listen. Listen to them. Daddy, can I tell you a story? Oh, talk to your mother. I'm just exhausted. Come on, sit down, listen, okay? Listen, and listen to their concerns, and listen when they're angry with you, and listen when they're upset with something. But also, my brothers, teach. Too many men are no longer teaching their children. And if you don't teach them, somebody else will. And it won't just be your wife. It'll be the gang leader. It'll be the television. It'll be some idiot musician. You see what I'm saying? I'm not saying all musicians are idiots, but you get the point, right? You know? Your kids will be taught. Just a question of by whom. All right? Listen to them. Find out what's happening in their life. And they're not going to tell you everything. I was not born yesterday. I know that. Yeah. But your wife and you have a good sense, and you know what's going on in those kids' life. Listen. Know what's going on. And talk to them and teach them. Say, look, I know that this is hard, but this is the way we need to walk, okay? And that's a beautiful mercy. Now, I'm just trying to get through a few of these kind of quickly so we can have a little bit of conversation time, all right? I want you also to hear, and some of this is paradoxical, obviously you need to praise your kids. You know, say, hey, you really did a great job, see? I'm impressed with what you've done here, see? I remember nothing would please me more than to mow the grass and have my father say, now that's the way it's done, son. You did a great job here. Look at those lines are straight, and you edge the grass. That's a good job, son. I just lived, and I was thrilled when my father praised me. See? Beware that we don't just always criticize. You know, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? And there's something you can find to praise your kids about. Now, obviously more than that, I hope, but you see the idea. Look for opportunities to praise them, to build them up, and to encourage them. By the way, encourage doesn't just mean pat them on the back. To encourage means literally to summon someone to courage. Summon them to courage. And praising them and showing them when they've done well says, now you see, I know I can do it, and I'm going to do it again and again, and I'm going to get better. See? And so these are the things, you know, that obviously we need to praise. But I'm also going to tell you, we need to punish. I say we, because I'm a priest and I'm a different kind of a father, but we need to punish. Now, the book of Hebrews has a very powerful meditation. I thought to maybe bring my Bible up and read from it, but let me just summarize it for you. It's a rather lengthy passage, but it says, do not disdain the punishments of the Lord. For every son whom he has, he afflicts, that the son may learn to walk in the right way. So do not become despondent, but when the Lord punishes you and corrects you. For if you are not corrected, you are not a son, but a bastard. That's what it says literally in the Greek. You're not a son, but a bastard. But if you are punished, then you know you are still one of God's sons. Now, the word son is used, it could be used daughter, but you get the idea. Now, the fundamental understanding is that one of the works of God's mercy is to punish us. And then if we're not punished, we're a bastard. Now, the word bastard, of course, has a literal legal sense, but also a pejorative sense, right? So literally or legally, it means that a bastard is someone who doesn't have a father, or know his father, or have any father in his life. And, of course, pejoratively, what happens when a person doesn't have a father in their life? and they become a bastard. Uncorrectable. I will do that until no one will tell me what to do. That kind of stuff, right? That's a strong tendency. And we see that in our culture today, where so many children are without their fathers. We find a lot of them are incorrigible. They're feisty. They're prideful. They stand up to adults and they won't be told what to do. And that's part of the scene. But again, a father who has mercy and loves his children, starting with God the Father, it's a work of mercy to punish. Now, why? Well, what is the nature of punishment? The purpose of punishment is to help someone experience in a small way the effects of their wrongdoing so they don't experience it in a full and lasting way. Does that make sense? You want them to experience something, a small punishment, so they don't get the worst punishment. Now, my father would often say, son, sending you to your room for 3 hours. If you talk back to me and you talk back to your mother, now you need to learn something. You do that when you go out in the workplace and you're going to be fired. And you're not going to have any money, you're going to live on a park bench. Now, I don't want to spare you that. So you spend 3 hours in your room. But dad. No, you got to go. Because you've got to learn. And he would often, try to point forward into the future to me and say, now look, I'm going to make you unhappy today so you're not unhappy tomorrow in a worse way. See? He had the long view in mind, not just my happiness today. Oh, but Dad, all my friends are outside. My day's going to be ruined. Yeah, your day's going to be ruined, but I'm concerned about your life. And that's mercy. There's a mercy in that. Now, we don't have to lower the boom and do the hardest punishments. The idea, again, is to help children experience in small ways so they don't experience in bigger ways. Well, sometimes you got to escalate. I'm not here to tell you how to, all this, but you see the idea. It is a mercy for a father. It's a paradoxical mercy, but it's a mercy for a father to punish his children. There comes a very sad moment in Scripture when God says to certain nations and people that he just hands them over. He hands them over to their own iniquity. Romans chapter 1 says that because they suppressed the truth about God and so on, therefore God handed them over to all sorts of disorder. God just says, all right, the worst day of your life is when God says, your will be done. When he no longer punishes, it's a very terrifying thing, see? It's a work of mercy. There comes a moment when God says, well, I've tried everything, and the only thing I can do now is to no longer punish and let them experience the full fury of their foolishness. And maybe they'll repent at the end, you see? So again, to punish, I'm not talking about just reckless punishments. I'm talking about good, solid, measured punishments are works of mercy. But you got to kind of think of them that way so that you don't just vent your anger. I know that we can get frustrated and we punish, but it's not just to get the kid to straighten up and fly right. It's to vent our own anger. See, that's your issue. Don't put that on your kids. That goes back to point number two, get well. Okay. So we want to praise kids and we want to punish them. And both are a mercy. Both are merciful. You see, in our culture, we tended to equate love with kindness, right? Now, kindness is an aspect of love, but so is rebuke. So is rebuke. See, there are many. Love is a many splendored thing. Right? That's to say that in our culture we've tended to reduce. If you love me, you'll approve of what I'm doing, and that's very common with these identity politics people, right? So the gay community, for example, says, "Well, if you don't approve of what we're doing, you must hate us. You're a hater." Wait a minute. I love you and I care about you and I don't want you to fall into disorder. No, because you don't approve of what I'm doing. You hate me. You're a hater. To love me is to approve of everything I do. No, that's not what love is. Love wants what is best. Love wants the truth for everyone. See, starting with ourselves and, okay, you see the idea. So, but there's a lot of identity politics stuff. You see, that's where we sort of equate love with kindness. But kindness is an aspect of love, but so is rebuke, see? So is punishment, so is praise. It's all part of love. All right. So we need to listen to our children, but we also need to teach them. We need to praise them, but we need to punish them. And again, as I've been saying all along, there is to be a kind of long-term look. We're concerned about their character, not just their happiness today, see? So let me read to you. This is a book called Successful Fathers. Anybody ever seen this book? You can see it's not a big, heavy read. It's by a guy named James Stenson. A lot of good advice in here. And really remarkable descriptions of stuff I just never thought about in terms of family life. I don't have time to develop it. But I want to read to you just a little paragraph from him here. Let's see, 57. Successful fathers are confident of their authority. Confident of their authority. They know that fatherhood is not an elective office. Their authority as father does not come from the consent of the governed. Somebody say amen. It comes with the job. It comes from the responsibility given by God and taken on freely by the man himself when he became a father. Consequently, successful fathers are not afraid of being temporarily unpopular. Let me read that again. Successful fathers are not afraid of becoming temporarily unpopular. Their love for their children and their commitment to the children's long-term best interests, these are strong enough to override the kids' bruised feelings and their occasional reluctance to do the right thing. In short, such fathers do not permit what they don't approve of. Though they may have inner doubts at times about one decision or another, they know generally what God has done, and they know they have no doubt whatsoever about their right to make a decision and then make it stick. There's a crisis of authority in our culture. Now, it goes from two directions, right? The first direction is we hate authority. You know, the cultural revolution that set in the 60s and late 60s wasn't just the sexual revolution or the feminist revolution. Another big aspect of it was the rebellion against authority. Now, remember, the Vietnam War was going on. There was a lot of this kind of stuff. But, of course, it was an overreaction, right? So, it was a crisis. And basically, down with authority. When I was a kid, it was enough for my mother to say, we're going to church. Well, why are we going to go to church? Because the church says so. Oh, okay. I guess we go to church. That's the argument from authority. Today, not only would that argument not be effective, it would actually be, oh, all the more reason not to go. Because the authorities say so. Refuse authority. Question authority. You know, and that's the attitude today. Now, that's the problem going in this direction. But here's the bigger problem. Those who do have authority are frightened of using it and think that it's a good thing not to use it. See? Now, almost everyone in this room, except maybe the very youngest children I see over there, have authority of some kind, just sometimes because we're older. But obviously, as fathers, you have authority. As mothers, you have authority. But my gosh, if we've got authority, we have to use it. And we have to be willing to take the heat. There are going to be raised eyebrows. There's going to be, as we say in the Latin, non placet. It is not pleasing to me, see? But we have to do it anyway. Now, we don't, obviously, if you have authority, you want to try to develop consensus. You want to certainly listen to your wife. You want to certainly listen to some of the needs of your kids and their reactions. But at the end of the day, by gosh, if you have a decision to make, you got to make it. And you got to make the best decision you can, and you got to stick to it. Okay. And you're going to, maybe the kids will be unhappy today, but your main concern is for their long-term best interest. Okay. So that is a work of mercy when you become confident of your authority. Not pathological, I'm in charge, nobody questions me, but you have a confidence about your authority. And I have to learn that as a pastor, and I told you if you were in my talk outside, a huge problem today are silent pulpits, where priests are not teaching, they're afraid of not being liked, they're, stop that, Father, get over it. Your job isn't to be liked, your job is to herald the gospel, in season and out of season, preach, teach. Well, but, you know, they might be upset. So, Jesus upset a few people. Just because somebody's angry with you doesn't mean you did anything wrong. See? Now, we can learn effective ways and less effective ways, but at the end of the day, no matter how sweet you make the truth, some people are going to just say, I don't like it. And you still haven't done anything wrong. So St. Timothy was told by St. Paul, preach the gospel in season and out of season. In other words, whether it's popular or unpopular, there are parts of the gospel that are popular today. Feed the poor, care for the... There's parts that are not popular. Live chastely, stop all that stuff. Get married, stay married, etc. Marriage is a man and a woman, you see, and so on. Preach it anyway. Okay? And if they serve you up and nail you to the cross, well, you're in good company and say, hallelujah, Jesus, I got to suffer for the sake of the name. I don't mean to go out and be pathological, you know. But on the other hand, we have to be firm and clear. When we come to know the truth, just expect pushback, okay? Courage, my brothers. Having that courage Having a proper understanding of your authority and using it is a work of mercy. Paradoxical, but important. And then, so that's kind of what I wanted to say today. Now, I want to kind of open it up because I know that there might be, let's see, what do we have, 128. So we got about 15 minutes for some questions, commentaries, rebuttals, or additions. Before you do that, I want to just give you a little advertising. I have a little book outside there called 300 Questions and Answers on the Catholic Faith. It's priced to sell, $5. I'm not making any money. It's just the price it costs to make it. So I just encourage you, if you would like it, they're out at that tent. You can get them. I wrote that again. The idea, I write the question and answer column for our Sunday Visitor. And one of the things that I told you, if you were at the other talk, but if not, I'll tell you now. An awful lot of people say to me, too many of our priests aren't teaching anymore. They're just kind of exhorting. A lot of abstractions and generalities, do good, avoid evil, be nice, try not to yell at each other, have a nice day. Every sermon I ever heard growing up, three sentences, Jesus is challenging us to do better, try to do better, now please stand for the creed. Now, I'm not saying every priest, I'm just saying that this is a common complaint that there isn't teaching, that there isn't a clear teaching about moral topics that are in the news. For example, when the SCOTUS decision came out, I got in my pulpit and I preached on it. And I gave people handouts. I read the bishop's statement. Likewise, here a couple weeks ago, we had the terrible shootings in both the Dallas and the other two shootings that preceded it, or the deaths. And I preached about that. Or again, I gave a whole, when a lot of the LGBTQ stuff was coming out and the so-called transgender bathrooms and so on, I spoke to them about the theology of the body and why there's no such thing as gender, but we have a sex, male or female, and that's the man or the woman we've been created to be by God, and we have to come to discover that man and that woman and become that, see? And I gave some of the theology of the body, trying to teach. And I did do a lengthy thing because I had a regular homily, but for 5 minutes gave them a thumbnail and said, now please take this home and study it and read it and teach it to your kids. So teach, 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 and that's kind of the idea here, that if this will help. There's all sorts of different topics arranged differently. 300 questions and answers on the Catholic faith. All of them brief, but the book itself, I guess, is a couple hundred pages. Okay? So that's for you. And then I will be going to the Holy Land with Patrick Coffin. How many of you know Patrick Coffin and Catholic Answers? Right? Okay. He and I are leading a trip to the Holy Land. If any of you are interested in learning more about it, I have some flyers. It's not cheap. Never cheap to go over to the Holy Land. It's about $3,000, $3,500, but 11 days, and if you've never been to the Holy Land, wow, it's great. And I'd be happy to have you go with us, okay? So that's a couple little shameless plugs. Okay, questions, comments on what we've been talking about, and raise a hand or shout it out. Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm going to say maybe a third of us in this room is a little bit too late for the
reason. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where do we go from here?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so he, just for the sake of the recording that's being made too, he's saying, look, sometimes for some of us this is too late and our kids are raised and so on. Some of the best fathers are grandfathers. And I don't know, whenever your witness really comes alive and whatever, just start, wherever you are, start. Circle back to your kids. I have a fantasy sermon that will be given by every priest on a certain Sunday, and especially every bishop, to stand in the pulpit and say, I want to apologize on behalf of the entire church. We've been too quiet for too long. We have not taught you clearly on moral topics. Many of you have been led to believe there's no hell. People don't go there if there is one. Many of you have been led to believe it's okay to use contraception. Many of you believe that it's okay to go on and not bother coming to church. And I know I could come with a list. I want to apologize that we led you to think that. But from this day forward, that has to change. And we're going to get back into the business of proclaiming the whole gospel, the entire counsel of God. I apologize if I've ever been too quiet myself. I want you to pray that I will be bold. And I want you to pray that brother priests who will come after me will be bold. And that if any of our faithful have been lost to this weakness, that either I can reach them or some of you can reach them, but that we finally get back to them and shake them up and say, get a real man. You're going for a day of judgment. Get ready for it. See? Now, kind of a version in the family. You know, you can almost summon the kids and say, look, you know, whatever struggles I've had in the past, I want you to know I've really come to understand something. It's very critical. It's very, very critical for you to follow God, to get back to the sacraments. You know, without the sacraments and the Word of God and holy fellowship and prayer, we don't stand a chance. The devil is just strong and he's raging. But at least you'll stand a chance. I beg you to get back to God's house. Now, you can't, you know, I think you may have tried, you at least planted a seed. And sometimes, I'm going to tell you a quick story just so you don't lose heart. Almost every month or so in my rectory, the doorbell rings. Father, someone's down and needs to see a priest about confession. They'll get it right now. Bless me, Father, I've sinned. It's been 40 years since my last confession. Ooh, someone's been praying for you. Yes, right, Father. Says, well, tell me. And so anyway, you hear the confession, and they come back to the church. 40 years they've been away, see? One man came to me. I buried his wife the year before, and he came to me and says, Father, you buried my wife. I said, yeah, I remember. He said, you know, I never got baptized. She says, yeah, she told me. You know, I always preach in my sermon, get right with God. You know, I spend most of the time in my funeral sermons telling people to come to Jesus. Because 80% of them ain't going to church. They're not living, you know, anyway. But I'm not taking credit, but he showed up at my door a year later and said, my wife prayed. We were married for 61 years. This man was way up in his late 80s, up to getting close to 90. And he said, I finally come to give my life to God. She prayed all those years for me to be baptized. Father, I laughed at her, I scorned her, I mocked her. But I got to come to God now. Now, that woman planted those seeds, watered them with her tears, and died, and did not live, at least in this world, to see that. My doorbell rings, and I'm reaping a harvest that somebody else labored for. He died 3 months after I baptized him. Now, never give up. Keep preaching. I know you got to be careful not to just nag and so on, but in the family gatherings, I just want to make an announcement. You know, whatever you want to, however you want to phrase it. I'm not saying you would claim all the things I just did, but I'm just saying, just an urgent appeal, okay? So that's kind of how I would handle it. So you're never, you know, even after you die, it's not too late, okay? You can still keep praying. Like I say, you know, I may reap a harvest that you pray for, see? Okay? And you and I have reaped harvest that other people prayed for and worked for, all right? Other comments or questions? Yes, sir.
I have one. Never is too late. My father died 4 years ago, 78. And he always told me, no, son, that's not right what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You need to do it this way.
Yeah.
He always told me the right thing.
Yeah.
The only thing that I want to say is that it's never too late.
Yeah.
To do the right thing.
Amen. And you say he died 4 years ago, don't you? Yeah, okay. And here you are today, right? See? So you say, yeah, it's never too late. Sometimes we always, I think in America, and I'm not saying this is what goes to your comment, but there is a tendency for us to want instant results, you know. Well, look, I knocked on somebody's door, and they didn't fall on their knees and start worshiping Jesus. What do you think, huh? Doesn't work, does it? And again, it does, but sometimes the seed, you know, the sowing of the seed, that parable, sometimes it falls on rocky ground and so on, but sometimes it hits soil. And you're not the judge of that. God is. All we have is this obligation to go sow the seed. Sow the seed. And you let God worry about whether it falls on what kind of soil and how it gets watered and all those things, all right? So there is a work for all of us to do to keep sowing the seed, and God will bring in the harvest as he sees fit, all right? He's not going to force people who don't want to come to heaven to go to heaven. By the way, people often ask me, you know, why is there a hell if God is merciful? And the answer is respect. God respects our freedom. He's not going to force himself on us or his kingdom down. But Father, who wants to go to heaven? No, they don't. Not the real heaven. They want to go to a fake heaven, a made-up heaven, where all their favorite things are on the menu. But in heaven, heaven is the fullness of the values of the kingdom of God, which is love of enemy, love of my neighbor, love of God. God is first, I'm not. Chastity, generosity, care for the poor, and so on. There's a lot of people make on that list. A lot of people don't want a thing to do with it, starting with chastity. Starting with loving your enemy. I don't love my enemy. I'm going to kill my enemy. Okay. So, again, God's not going to force people to enter into a kingdom forever that they don't want. And they detest its values. If I got to go to heaven, he's in there. Heck. See, that's like the... Remember the parable of the son, the prodigal son. And Father's pleading, come into the feast. He says, not with that son of yours in there. I ain't coming in. And the story ends. Why is it end? Did he go in or didn't he? You have to finish the story. It's your story. Will you go into heaven on his terms with some people in there? You kind of wonder what they're doing in there. Or will you just go into a personal pocket you call you designed for yourself? By the way, that happens to be called in the Bible hell. Hell doesn't necessarily, I think there's a, and part of it is scriptural. I mean, most of the images of hell are fiery and terrifying, the worms dying not, but there could be some more subtle experiences in hell. Let me give you a quick joke. I mean, you may play golf. There's a golf joke that I'll show you. That sometimes the hell of things is just to be missing the one thing necessary. So there's a golfer. All he cared about was golf. He never loved anybody. He did not love God. He was grouchy. He didn't like anybody, but he did love golf. He played golf. Every Sunday, he'd play golf every chance he could get. Finally, he died, he went to hell. And Satan said, let me show you around. He shows him a golf course to die for, literally. And says, wow, look at the greens and the ground. And he's like, wow, man, give me a set of golf clubs. Satan handed him a golf club, a pair of golf clubs that were practically made for him. Literally, they were making them for him. They knew he was coming. Oh, man, Satan, if I have died and gone to hell, this is heaven for me. Well, I said, give me a golf ball. Let me just go ahead and tee off and start enjoying it now. And Satan says, you know, we don't have any golf balls in hell. That's the hell of it. In other words, maybe sometimes hell is to be just missing the one thing necessary. And you know, we were made for God. And if we find you reject him, we're going to be miserable. All right? But it may not always be worms dying not and endless fire. It could be maybe more subtle things like that, right? So, I haven't toured hell, and I know Sister Faustina certainly gave all the saints gave awful vision of hell. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's a pleasant place. But I think some of the sufferings are more subtle than just fire and worms and stuff, okay? Other comments, questions? We got a few more minutes. Yeah.
Appreciate what you say about a father's love and love of his wife is one of the best things he can do, and being the spiritual leader as well.
Yeah.
There are so many things that you said that I appreciate. Do you have a booklet or a CD of some sort on? I already bought that because I heard your first talk and I appreciate what you said in your first talk.
Yeah.
But do you have a booklet of sort on, Father Ben, and do some of those things you mentioned?
I don't yet. So pray for me. I get it together. You can go on my blog and just type Father or Fatherhood. You'll see a lot of some of my blog posts will pop up. So some of these things are out there, but you know, some of them I just do in settings like this too. So I said, yeah, I did record this song, so it'll be posted. I'll give Heather who's coordinating this conference, I'll give her the links to my talks, and you can download them and or listen to them online. But I'm grateful for your comments. And I will say that, by the way, I am not unaware, man, that Father, you don't know my wife. Now, I don't mean to put all the pressure on men, but I'm here talking mainly to men. And I know it's hard. I know it's sometimes hard to say, love your wife. I know that's not always, you know. And look, there can be some really painful things that set up in marriages on both sides. So, but I mean, just beg for a miracle if you got to. But this is not just, I'm not just trying to scold men and say it's all your fault. And I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, though, that with, if we're talking about mercy and fatherhood, just ask God to help you to really, really love the mother, the children, the children's mother, namely your wife, okay? And God will do that. He'll answer. You know, when that priest told me to go and pray for a greater love for my people, I did. And God's given me a very tender love for my people. And not just my people, but I love to come and be in settings like this. I love you, and I care about you. And I know you love me and care about me. And in the context of love, the priest said, look, if you love people, and they know you love them, you can tell them almost anything, and they'll listen. Now, they may not be able to live it right away, but they'll listen. Because they know the difference. There are too many priests who are just angry getting stuff off their chest. That's not the purpose of a sermon. The purpose of a sermon is to show love by teaching the truth in love. My ordaining bishop, Cardinal Hickey, his motto was Veritate in Caritate, the truth in charity. So charity with clarity, clarity with charity. But charity, love. This wins the day. Now, and it may sound cheesy, a little bit cheesy. I don't mean a cheesy kind of a love. I mean a deep, abiding, manly love that wants really what's best for your wife, for your children, and yes, an affectionate love, too. It's an important love. And so the Lord answered my prayers. And every time I've been reassigned, which I hope isn't going to be anytime soon, I hate being reassigned. When you love people, it's hard to leave. You know? But wherever I go, the first thing I do is I go to the church and kneel down and say, help me love them. Help me love them. Right now I'm scared. I don't know them. And there's certain things he like, what he like, I heard about him. There's a little bit of that at the beginning. Just break through that, Lord. Give love. In that context of love and trust, I can teach almost anything. And the people will listen. I still have a few that walk out on me in moments of controversy, but they'll be back. Okay, one last one, maybe? Yeah?
So, when are you going to give this special homily to the bishops?
Yeah. When am I going to give this special homily to the bishops? I don't know. Yeah. I can tell you that when I do get any kind of a relationship with the bishop, I won't go into detail, but I've certainly had some very conversations with Cardinal Orlon. To his credit, he listens. I mean, he doesn't say, you can't talk to me that way, I'm the bishop, you know. He's not like that. But I say, you know, Your Eminence, really, we've got to be more clear in teaching. And I think to his credit, Cardinal Orlon's very good at defining the problems. He's written some very good pastoral letters. And as I say, I think that let's pray a lot for bishops. And I'll tell you one thing about a bishop. Anyone who ever wants to be a bishop is already excluded himself. He's obviously insane. Just commit him now. Because bishops have very lonely lives. They're not in relationships like we pastors can be with people. Usually when the bishop shows up, it's like for confirmation. Oh, he's coming. Oh, gosh. You know, find out what he wants to eat. Okay. And you sit there. You bring him in. You sit there. Oh, good bishop. Everything's wonderful. Oh, you're doing such great work, bishop. We're just so happy you're here today. And, you know, there's a lot of phony talk goes back and forth. He goes out. He does the confirmation. Everyone's tense. And finally, you show him to the door. Whew, the door closes. Thank God he's gone. And that's a very lonely life. Now, I'm doing a little bit of a cartoonish version, but it's a kind of a truth. Who really loves the bishop? Who's he really close to? And it's kind of hard. You go from place to place. You carry your bag and go from place to place. And you're not really known. There's an old saying that among bishops that says, two things are guaranteed when you're ordained a bishop. You'll never have a bad meal again. And you'll never hear the truth again. And let's be honest, we tend to isolate people in authority. We tell them what we think they want to hear, and a lot of times they only know what they hear. And no, so I'm not trying to say that there aren't things to rebuke and maybe encourage bishops as well as priests, but I would say that keep praying, keep working, and encourage the bishops, encourage them. Encourage your priests when they speak boldly, and encourage bishops too, because they're going to get pushback. It comes with the territory, and you want to make sure if they're going to get pushback, they get encouragement too, right? So anyway, I wish I could say I have a pulpit to speak to them. I don't. Actually, I do go around the country, though, giving a lot of priest retreats. I just gave one in Kansas City, and I'll be going to Denver in October to give the priest retreat there, and so I get to interact with bishops and priests a lot doing that, you know. I say some of these things there. Okay, well, bless you. Okay, yes, one. Yeah.
I'm from Europe, and I know that, for example, speaking against homosexual marriages is going to be a pain
crime. Yeah.
And say right now in Canada, so lots of priests being put in jail, which is speaking against them. That's where the fear comes and courage comes.
Yeah.
Well, we have 8 years old. What's your foresee like 30 years from now? Are we still going to have church that will speak for the truth?
Well, I don't know, but I know that I'm willing to go to jail. And the day they pass the law that says it's a hate crime, I will get in the pulpit of my church and I will read from the catechism and I will read from the scripture and I say, come arrest me. I think we have to be willing to just stand up against this kind of thing and say, oh, look. And again, I don't know the situation in Europe and how it's gotten that bad. I know they don't have a tradition of free speech like we do in this country, but by gosh, they ought to. And I will say this, and Europe went through a terrible time, and there were two world wars and the Cold War and just endless issues in Europe that have led to a very strong secularism and a turning away of the faith. It's going to be a long journey back. Pope Benedict said the lights are going out everywhere in Europe, and he meant the lights of the gospel. And right now, Europe is largely, I think, little by little, just being replaced by a Muslim. There'll be a Muslim caliphate all throughout Europe. I don't doubt that. But I will say that somewhere along the line, the gospel was not being handed on. I don't know what point there was a tipping point. I remember if you read St. Luke, C.S. Lewis's Latin letters. He had a correspondence with a priest in Italy. He didn't know Italian, and the Italian priest didn't know English, but every educated man in those days knew Latin, and they wrote back and forth in Latin. And Lewis is very bold in those letters. And he's writing in 1948. This is very right after the war, and very early. He says, everywhere the faith is dead in Europe. It's dead. Now, back in the 40s in this country, my gosh, our churches were bursting at the seams, you know? The 50s were like church on steroids. You know, everybody went to church. But in Europe by that time, the faith was dying, in fact, all but dead. And see, that's what C.S. Lewis, he says, some people say we've gone back to the barbarian years. I wish we had, he said. I wish we were barbarians. At least the barbarians believed in a higher power. At least the barbarians had a sense of natural law. People here today have none of that. The ancient Europe was waiting was a virgin waiting for her husband. Modern Europe is an angry divorcee. And that's C.S. Lewis. That's C.S. Lewis talking like that. And that was in the 1940s. So I don't know where the tipping point came, but somewhere along the line, the gospel eroded and people were no longer preaching and handing it on. And that's happening now in our country. It's been happening for a while, obviously. And all I can say is the only solution is to boldly preach it and to accept the consequences and to say if it means martyrdom, if it means jail, if it means... Now, it's easier for me as a priest. I don't have a family. You've got decisions to make. When do I stand up and how much? And you know. But at the end of the day, I hope all of us at some point are willing to say, I will die rather than be told I cannot preach the truth. So, as I say, if that law ever passes, first Sunday, I'm in my pulpit. Come and get me. Come and get me. But again, I have less to lose than some of you. So, okay, another quick one. We're going to run a little late, but all right.
What are you telling to your Christian pharmacist right now in Washington State?
In Washington State, yeah. Civil disobedience time.
Pardon?
Civil disobedience. Now, again, I'm saying the same thing, and I used to do it. Has anyone talking to the bishops? I stood up in a meeting with several bishops. And I said, when will we come to the point when we finally have to say, we will not comply, and if you fine us, we will not pay the fines, and if you want to come and shut us down, we'll have to keep dangling in front of you with all the cameras rolling and all the old ladies in the nursing home out at the edge, because you're not going to comply. And, oh, we're not there yet. I said, I know. When do we ever get there? I don't know. Again, that's just lacking to it.
They're there now.
Yeah.
Right. They're there now. You're a pharmacy right now. You're a Christian. You're there.
Okay. Yeah. Again, I don't know except to say... If they're asking what I will do, I will not comply. I will not comply. And, I would certainly, maybe before I jump to the podium and say I will not comply, maybe try to develop a kind of a legal assistance network and really be willing to, because, at the end of the day, civil disobedience does at some point work. You have to build a critical mass, and civil rights movement shows that, right? They had to work very hard for over decades, for several decades to really build critical mass. By gosh, they did it, and they simply said, I will not comply with the students as I can't sit at the lunch counter. I will sit here. And you can arrest me, you can throw a hot coffee on me, you can shoot me or hit me with a water cannon. I will not comply. Now, I'm not going to do violence to you. I'm not going to blow up stuff. I'm not going to riot. But I simply will not cooperate with evil. And that's martyrdom. It's maybe bloody, but it's lesser forms. Whew, it's hard times. It's going to get harder. It's going to get harder. And I am not going to sit in judgment on pharmacists who have six kids and if I'm going to have to comply for a while and I'm going to figure a way out of this, but whatever. I'm not here to make an individual decision for everybody, but I would say that's if you're going to ask me a direct question, what do I do? That's what I say. Sorry, easy for me to stand up here and say it though. Another quick hand. I want to respect everybody's time. It's right now. I'm going to give you the time. It is 1:52. We should have ended about 7 minutes ago. So how about one more? And we'll wrap it up, okay? Yeah.
How about the other way? We're talking about fatherhood and Christian. Without, if you have, trying to get your parents into a similar mindset position as you want to get your kids into.
Can you repeat? I'm not quite sure I understand.
So, you're going the other way. We talked about, that teaching our kids, bringing our kids up to the faith. What about the other way, if we're having the same challenge that
oh, yeah, your parents aren't in compliance. Yeah. Well, again, St. Thomas says that the requirement to give fraternal correction varies based on the relationships. So, obviously, a parent is 100% required to correct their children. A child is not 100% required to correct their parents, or an inferior to a superior. So the demand of fraternal correction, the demand of fraternal correction doesn't always, you know, have the same obligation. That said, I think, you know, in a respectful way, you know, to